It is 7:30 and time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Marilyn Watkins, who is with the Economic Opportunity Institute, and Steve Kofall, who is with the Social Security Administration and a representative of the American Federation of Government Employees. And we're going to be discussing privatizing government jobs and its effect on our local community. Thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let me start and ask if you could give us what the current situation is in terms of government employees and what's currently being proposed in terms of privatization.
Okay. First of all, I want to explain that, as you said, I am a Social Security Administration employee, but I'm certainly here on behalf of the American Federation of Government Employees. Social Security, like every other federal agency, is very heavily involved in privatization, and they certainly would not agree with the things I'm going to be saying today. The Bush administration, as part of their management agenda, which I call a mismanagement agenda, as a centerpiece of that, intends to privatize, or at least study for privatization, nearly a million jobs held currently by federal employees across the country. That includes the Social Security Administration, Veterans Administration, Department of Defense, basically across the board. And they've established quotas that they expect managers to meet in order to reach their goal over a period of time. So that's a very big threat right now.
And how long has this been going on for? Is this just the Bush administration that's started proposing this, or was this something that's been in the works for a while?
Actually, to some extent, the Clinton administration was moving in that direction in a much more modest fashion. But in that case, at least, employees, their union representatives, and the people that ran the programs in the individual agencies had a lot more to say about whether or not we would be moving in that direction. In this case, essentially, from the time the president came into office, he's made it part of his program on an ideological basis rather than a business basis.
And I think one of the things that is important to keep in mind, actually, government has had some of its services privatized since the very beginning, since we were founded as a nation. You know, some services that government has performed has been privatized. So to some extent, it's nothing new. But for the last 20 years, there's been this ideologically driven push to privatize more and more government jobs. And there's been an ideology that's been pushed on the American people that anything that private businesses do is going to be more cost effective, more efficient, better than anything government does. That's ideologically driven. That's an ideology. It's not something that's found based in fact. When we go and actually look at studies that are done of comparing services that are privatized versus services performed by government, the studies that are done well and scientifically actually have not found any consistent way in which privatized services are more cost effective than services performed by government employees.
And I think it's pretty obvious if people just think about the motive that private industry has, is to make a profit. Government employees don't make a profit. All we do is pay for the services we deliver. The employees who deliver those services, their wages, their benefits, and program administration itself, we don't have to make something on top of that to make a profit. So it's a natural expectation that government employees can do the work better and at the same or lower cost than private individuals could.
So they're looking at potentially privatizing just short of a million jobs. Is that how many federal employees are there total? Is that also basically the number of federal employees?
That represents about half of the federal workforce now, although it's a bit misleading because two-thirds of the people that do government work now are already contractors. But there's approximately 1.7 million federal employees that are still remaining. It's actually the smallest government we've had since the Kennedy administration.
So just for example, one of the areas that there's been a real emphasis on privatizing has been information technology, so that the push is to get about a third of information technology jobs privatized. But there have been some real problems with that. And when we think about not only issues of identity theft, of confidentiality, but also issues of national security, it can be a real problem when massive databases, confidential private information, not only on us as individual private citizens, but on our military personnel, on other people who are in vital government jobs that have big national security implications, when those kinds of databases are controlled by the private sector and not by government employees, we have some serious problems. Just for example, last year in Phoenix, the hard drives were stolen from a private company that had the databases for over half a million military personnel. All of their confidential, private, personal information was stored on those hard drives that was stolen out of the offices of a company where a private company where that data was being held.
And in the Social Security Administration, our agency has told us recently that we will soon have the largest single database in the entire world because we have records about earnings. We have personal identifying information that, as Marilyn said, can be used as a basis for identity theft. We have medical records on many people who file for disability benefits. And as that is more and more automated and put in electronic form, it's much more vulnerable. And we're concerned, for instance, that a real possibility is that our toll-free number where people call to get information and to make changes in their records could be privatized, and there would be access to that database by private contractors who aren't really controlled by the government at all. In fact, with the international trade agreements that are now being negotiated, there's the real possibility that work could go overseas, so it wouldn't even be controlled within this country.
Well, it also seems with a lot of coverage lately of how corporations are selling off their databases, I mean, that's a way that they make money, that would be a pretty sweet little gift for some of them to get their hands on.
Oh, absolutely. I agree.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, some other examples of ways in which people actually could lose out significantly. Think about our national parks. Already a lot of the jobs in our national parks are done by private contractors. When you go and buy trinkets at the souvenir shop or when you go and buy food at the concessions, those jobs are already done by private contractors in our national parks. But the park rangers, the people that are actually the experts on the terrain, the natural wildlife that's there in the park, that know the routes that people hike on, that know the safe routes, that know how to do CPR, that love the park and love love maintaining it and love sharing that with the general public. Those people are government workers who have a service and ethic of real commitment of service to the public, of service to maintaining that facility. That's something that's hard to replicate by going into the private sector and doing it, contracting it out to people who are typically lower paid, have less job security, have a lot less expertise and knowledge, have far worse benefits in terms of health and pension benefits. There's a lot lost in terms of what the public receives when those kinds of jobs go from someone who's committed to the job for public service to someone who's just hired cheaply to fill a slot.
And what Marilyn was talking about is something in the Social Security Administration that could impact on our community here in the Puget Sound area. My local represents approximately 1,500 Social Security employees in four states, but about half of them are in the Puget Sound area, and 500 of them work in a call center in Auburn, Washington. If we lose 500 living wage union jobs out of that call center, it's going to impact that community and the communities around Auburn in a very big way, because, again, that work is very likely to be moved elsewhere, even offshore, and we would be taking a lot of money out of the economy that we can't afford to lose at this point. We all know what's happened with the movement of work from Boeing, from other businesses in the Puget Sound area. This just would add to the pain for everyone.
Yeah, where we see, for instance, again with Boeing, where multiple states are scrambling to get that 77 contract, which I believe equates to about 800 jobs from what I've read. You're talking about 500 jobs, which seems pretty comparable, the region could lose from this. And you say it could get moved offshore.
Yes, actually, there are five states that have contracted out their call answering function. And those contractors in at least five states have moved that function to Bombay, India, where call center workers who are paid far less than workers in this country, but speak English very well and are trained in American culture and are even trained to speak in American accents, are answering questions from people who call in for information or to make changes in their welfare records in those five states. Unbeknownst to them, they're talking to somebody in a foreign country who has access to confidential records.
I know also that that as an example, things getting privatized, for instance, prisons, there's been a move to privatize them. And I don't know, connected in my head when you're talking about people answering phones, because I know telemarketers that call you up, there's a significant percentage of them that call from prisons, which is I'm just picturing, you know, maybe that Social Security would start having their calls, you know, covered by prisoners.
There was a serious proposal about 8 years ago that the Social Security Administration was actually considering that would have had prisoners answering those calls. Can you imagine prisoners having access to the addresses, phone numbers, financial information for children and adults who are receiving Social Security benefits across the country? It was an incredible proposal that was actually being given some serious consideration at that time, and it could happen again.
But, you know, speaking of prisons, you know, that's that's one of the areas where there has been a real push to privatize prisons. And there's been some who really stand to profit from doing private prisons who've really pushed hard this agenda of privatizing prisons, claiming that, in fact, they can build them cheaper, house people cheaper, run them cheaper than the government can. But the studies that have been done that really compare public and private prisons have really found that there's no cost savings to the public from doing it. And in fact, then what you find, since there's no cost savings, but you have some private company who's having to make a profit, and you do have government workers who have to then monitor the contracts, monitor compliance, assure quality standards, rather than actually performing those services themselves, they have to be monitoring. So you have additional costs that aren't present when you have the public entity, the government, providing that service. The way that you don't end up having it be more costly is you take it out of the workers' pay and the workers' benefits, so that instead of having the prison guards, the people who work in the cafeteria and whatnot, do all the support for the prison, do really important jobs. Instead of those jobs being good living wage jobs, good family wage jobs, those jobs become low pay, poverty generating jobs instead. And so we don't really either get the benefit in terms of cost savings to the taxpayers, and we take a hit in our total community when we look at the effects on our total community of having a good wage base in our communities.
And what Marilyn said about managing contracts, it's also important to understand that the record is not good on government managing contracts for the public. They don't put the personnel or the money into it. We don't have the money in our budgets currently to pay for the studying of jobs for contracting out or the managing of those contracts. And as a result, we're taking money away from direct public service delivery to fund that, even though it's not considered in the total budget because of this ideological push to privatize so many jobs.
And I think this gets to sort of the fundamental ideological difference here, is that those who are pushing privatization believe that the profit motive, that there's something good and pure about the profit motive. Now, I think all of us here would support private businesses making profits, and we see a real value to having a private sector that's healthy and profitable, and it, have no problem with that. But government has a very different purpose from private businesses. When we think about the words in the founding documents of our country, when we think about the purpose of our federal government that's laid down in our Constitution, it's very different from making a profit. It's to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, to promote the general welfare, to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our prosperity. So the purposes of government are really to look out for the whole community now, everybody in the community now, and in the future. So we're looking out for the common welfare for all of us and the long-term effects on individuals, on their life chances, and also on the life chances of future generations. That's a fundamentally different purpose. And it needs to be so that many of the things that government does, rather than being contracted out for short-term profit, really need to take this much larger view of serving the whole long-term public good.
And I think that's a very important distinction that Maryland draws. The equity of service delivery is something the government, as a matter of law and regulation, is required to deliver. In other words, if you have a hard-to-serve population, a government employee is required by law and regulation to serve everyone, and all of those people will be taken care of. A private corporation, on the other hand, is driven to make profit. Therefore, you can't expect the same equity of service where you have a hard-to-reach or expensive-to-serve population. We have a lot of moves now on government postal services in Canada and the U.S. in efforts to privatize that work. And we feel that rural communities and the poor will be poorly served as compared to what they're served now.
Talk a little bit more about the Social Security Administration. I understand they actually have a very low overhead. Is that true for running the organization?
Yes. The total receipts that come in to the Social Security system, only 1.5% of those, approximately, actually a little less than that, are spent on program administration now. Where the Bush administration is pushing to establish individual investment accounts and privatize the program itself, we know that stock market brokers are going to charge far more than that to manage individual accounts for virtually every citizen in the country. And as a matter of fact, the privatization of the program and the trust funds is something that is moving forward quite rapidly now, behind the scenes, under the smoke screen, as all of our attention is diverted to war and terrorism. There is a big move mounting to privatize the Social Security system and turn it over to Wall Street. And we believe that current and future beneficiaries will be poorly served by that. And we know that the transition costs to go into a system like that could run as high as $2 trillion out of general funds. We just don't have that money due to the tax cuts that have been passed recently that benefit primarily wealthy individuals.
Yeah, we've been talking so far mainly about privatizing government jobs themselves, but Social Security is a good example of the same ideology that's really trying to push the privatization of the actual service itself. And Social Security is an example of a program that has been phenomenally successful. We've come close to eliminating poverty among the elderly in our country. We haven't quite gotten there yet, and far too many of our elderly live really close to poverty. But we have come close to eliminating poverty among our elderly, which had been a rampant problem up until the 1940s and 50s. Social Security also goes far beyond a retirement system. It also provides essential insurance for workers who become disabled and for their families and supporting them, and also for the children of workers who die. It's an essential support for those kids. So it has been a phenomenally successful program. And here again, it's a situation where there's this myth out there that, A, the Social Security system is in serious trouble, and B, that a private system would actually be cost effective and would actually serve people better in the long run. Both of those things are really false, and particularly the second one, that people would be better served by a private system. The vast majority of Americans would be far worse off financially under a privatized system when you actually run the numbers out and look at the numbers. And in addition to actually having less money in their pocket, the insecurity that people would have under a privatized system, the gambles that people would be taking, and the knowledge that if they live too long, they're going to run out of money and their last years are going to be in dire poverty, or if anything happens to them, their kids are going to be in dire poverty. That kind of insecurity is something that, it's hard to put a price tag on that.
One of the things that I find rather obscene, as a matter of fact, is the fact that our agency, the managers of our agency who are supposed to be running the program for the benefit of the public, are actually promoting the privatization that Marilyn was talking about. Last month, I was talking to a cab driver in a casual conversation, and the subject turned to Social Security. And the first words out of his mouth were, "I don't believe it'll be there for me." And I said, "Well, why is that?" He said, "Social Security told me that. They sent me a personal earnings and benefit estimate statement, and the message in that statement was that the system isn't going to be there for me and that the system needs some sort of reform." Well, the reform that they were talking about was privatization, which would actually hasten the day when Social Security runs out of money, not solve the problem at all. So our agency is actually spending public taxpayers' money to promote this agenda by doing mailings to every individual in the country. And when someone calls in on our toll-free number and is placed on hold because our staff has been cut and our ability to deliver service has been crippled, they also get a similar pitch in the greeting while they're on hold in queue waiting for a call to be answered. So the agency itself is promoting this political agenda for the Bush administration, and that, again, is something different than what I've ever seen before prior to this current regime.
And we all know that the baby boomers are going to be retiring in the next 10, 20 years. We know that there's this population bulge that's going to be coming through and putting a strain on Social Security. What tends to be forgotten is that for the last 20 years, we've actually been saving money for that. You know, it's not like no one noticed that the baby boomers were out there. And people noticed this over 20 years ago. And over 20 years ago, actually, the payroll taxes that we pay for Social Security that get deducted from our paychecks, most of us don't really even notice it, except when we first start making money and first realize we're not going to get our full, you know, the full thing that we earned. That's actually been higher than needed to pay current benefits. So that the benefits that are now going out to my grandma, actually now to my parents, to the children of deceased workers, to disabled workers and their families, those benefits that are now going out, we're actually paying in more in taxes, in our Social Security payroll taxes, than is required to provide those benefits. So we've been saving money in anticipation of this population bulge of the baby boomers coming through. And we actually have enough saved up, or we will. I mean, you know, we haven't quite finished saving yet, but the baby boomers are now in their prime earning years. So the baby boomers are socking away money into the Social Security Trust Fund to finance their own retirement. And that money's there. It's safely invested in Treasury bonds. It earned $65 billion in interest last year. You know, even as the stock market was tanking, the Social Security Trust Fund was still earning a nice little bit of interest that was going back into the trust fund, saving up for the retirement of the baby boomers. So we actually have enough saved up to get us through until I'm a baby boomer. So, you know, until those in my demographic group start dying off eventually, which we will, and then that increase in the elderly population is going to start leveling off. So that both that demographic bulge that's coming through and the longer lifespans that we are all hoping for, anticipating, those have already been taken into account. And when we look at the long-term projections that are done, the Social Security Administration every year does three different projections, 75-year projections, if you can imagine trying to project out anything 75 years into the future. But they project out for 75 years three different scenarios, different lifespans, different rates of economic growth, different rates of unemployment, different rates of immigration and whatnot, and say, okay, worst-case scenario, middle-case scenario, best-case scenario. Those projections show that in all likelihood, if we have even less growth economically than we had over the last 50 years, if in the next 50 years we have even about two-thirds the rate of growth that we had in the last 50 years, then we'll be just fine. The Social Security taxes that are being paid in will be sufficient not only to maintain benefits, but actually people will be getting twice the level of benefits even after being adjusted for inflation 40 years from now than they're getting today. We're not talking about just people getting the same level of benefit as today. We're talking about, because benefits are based on average wages, and average wages tend to go up a little higher than the rate of inflation each year, about 1% higher than the rate of inflation each year. People 40 years from now will be earning about twice as much as they are today on average after adjusting for inflation. and Social Security beneficiaries will be receiving from the Social Security twice as big a benefit in terms of its buying power as people getting Social Security are today.
Another thing is that I think a lot of the doomsayers on Social Security fail to recognize that we have considerable immigration into this country. We have more and more people coming in and working here and contributing to the system. We have more older workers who are staying in the workforce, and that also brings more money into the system. If there is going to be a shortfall, one of the ways you could take care of virtually all of it would be to have earners who make more than $87,000 a year continue to pay Social Security tax on their additional earnings. Right now, if you make $87,000 a year, after that you stop paying Social Security. So if we were just to equalize that and have them contribute their full share, we would take care of any shortfall that may actually exist. But as Marilyn said, the demographics can be interpreted any way you want, depending on your political agenda. But in reality, we feel that the system is very secure. And it's really ideology that is trying to scare people into believing that privatizing the system, privatizing the jobs, is a good thing.
And I think, you know, we want to think about, is it, do we really want a society where it's every individual for themselves and everyone is just has to take their chances? If they suffer a run of bad luck, too bad for them. They probably deserve that bad luck. Or do we want a system where people who work and contribute can have some security? I look at my 96-year-old grandmother, who's lived almost exclusively on Social Security since my grandfather died in 1971. My grandma's 96 years old today. My grandfather and my grandmother worked hard all of their working lives. At the end of his life, my grandfather made an investment which he thought was going to set his family up to be financially secure, invested their savings in that. Turned out to be a disastrous investment through no fault of his, certainly through no fault of my grandmother's. My grandmother has far outlived her life expectancy. She's outlived all of her siblings, all of her sisters-in-law. She's outlived everyone else in her generation. Yet she's been able to be financially secure. She hasn't lived in luxury, but she's had enough to live on for the last over 30 years now, thanks to Social Security. And I don't think we really want to be throwing out people like my grandma and making them live under bridges, saying we are not going to care for our elderly. We're not going to care for people who become disabled through no fault of their own. We're not going to care for orphans in our society. I think we want to live in a society where people are taken care of.
And one of the other things that we've seen with the dismantling, essentially, of the Social Security Administration or the plan to do so is that for a number of years, starting with the Reagan administration and then picking up again more with the Bush administration, we've seen a withdrawal of the Social Security Administration from delivering direct community service. There is a proposal that's been announced to close the Linwood Social Security office. There are rumors that two Social Security offices in Seattle will be closed. And the agency is very aggressively directing more and more people to self-service via the Internet. And is also working with what they call third parties to outsource work, either through contracts or otherwise, so that the work is not even done by agency employees. As they continue to make the agency less and less able to deliver service, it helps to promote privatization because those who would propose that we privatize government services can say, well, it's not working very well now. And there's a reason for that. They've underfunded, they've cut staff, and they've withdrawn from delivering community-based service that people need. We serve the most vulnerable population possible, the aged and disabled, and survivors of a deceased wage earner. And those people need to have personal service by people who know what they're doing and have a public service motive rather than a profit motive that's driving them.
We are just about out of time talking this morning with Marilyn Watkins, who's with the Economic Opportunity Institute, and Steve Kofel, who's with the American Federation of Government Employees. What, real quickly, what can people do to stop the privatization of Social Security and to support those people and those living wage jobs currently being held by a million around 1 million people, as you said earlier, Steve. And how can people get a hold of your organizations?
Well, for me, the easiest way to contact me is by email, and I'll spell out the email address. It's stevekofahl@AOL.com. And the best way that people can fight this is to contact their congressman, to talk to their friends and neighbors about what's going on, but to contact Congress, their local congressmen, their senators, and say, please, do not privatize government services. Right now, the Bush administration is trying to force privatization of the Medicare system, for instance, as a price for a drug benefit. It's the same political ideology that's driving that, and Social Security will be next. And if people care about those programs that are vital to the income security of our most vulnerable citizens, they need to contact their congressman and let them know how they feel about it.
And you can contact me and actually read a lot more about particularly Social Security, but also a number of other issues on my website, our website, which is www.eoionline.org, EOI as in Economic Opportunity Institute, online, that's all one word, eoionline.org. We have a lot of information about Social Security, but also a number of other issues, and you can get my email off that website.
Very good, Steve.
Just one quick comment I'd like to make. I'd like to invite anyone who would like to join us to meet us at the Labor Temple at 2800 First Avenue at 10 a.m. this morning. We are going to be marching down to the piers and talking about international trade. And international trade in services is a very big deal now. It represents 70% to 80% of our economy, and that's where the jobs are going to be taken offshore next. So come down and learn about that and help us oppose it.
Very good. Well, Marilyn Watkins and Steve Kofel, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.